Our next speaker is Rosalie Rugg, the person who was at the very beginning of the Economic Assessment Office. It's a pleasure for us to have her here today. And let me emphasize, as we go throughout the day, understand this is a combination of science and economics, social science and science, very unique aspect. So Rosalie, and I guess Susan will...
We're moving along just fine. Is there a question as I bring up the slides?
I have a niggling back of my mind wonder, why did ATT, the enabling legislation expired? Is that what it is? Why is it no longer ATT?
That's a very good question. I don't know. How about a non-federal employee, Rosalie? We're going to pick on you. Maybe that question will be answered during... Okay.
What a way to start.
Yes.
But as I quipped, it wasn't because it wasn't good. Let's put it that way. Right. Probably, well, no doubt, the most evaluated program for its size ever in government. I mean, I feel confident in making that claim. And it always came up very strong from an evaluation standpoint. And so what I was asked to do, and I thank you to the conference organizers for inviting me, was to speak a little bit about the history of the evaluation at ATT, but I didn't want to jump in talking about billions and billions of years ago kind of talk. I want to start with how you set up an evaluation program and then anchor back to ATT. Let's see. Let me make sure I've got the arrow right.
The arrow up and down.
Okay, up and down. Okay, up, down. Okay. So what I'm going to do today is talk about starting an evaluation program now, if you were doing it today, and then jump back and talk about starting ATP's evaluation 18 years ago, and then a little bit on challenges and lessons learned. Starting an evaluation program now. Now, first of all, there are public programs today that are starting evaluation programs ground up. The ones that I'm familiar with that are really doing this from scratch are largely abroad. And the reason is we've had now since 93, the GPRA in effect, and we've had PART in effect since 2001. And so most of your federal U.S. programs have done something by now. Very few would have done nothing. And but there are some programs abroad that I've had the good fortune to be involved with that are creating their evaluation programs. About, I think it was two or three years ago, I was asked to join an international team to develop to perform an interim assessment of Austria's genomic grant program. It was a new program. It was their first targeted scientific program. They had a general NSF kind of program in effect, but this was the first time they had done a top-down, named the technology, named the innovation, and then focused a grant program in that area. The program was 4 years old. It had not been evaluated. It had no evaluation plan. And so the evaluation team was to evaluate it, but my job in particular was to develop an evaluation assessment program for them. So, and then something that's happening today that's even broader, and it kind of blew my mind when I saw the invitation for proposals, is Chile recently requested tenders for creating a national innovation system evaluation program. And it's across ministries. It has multi tiers. And I was asked again by an international team to participate in that. They haven't really made the awards yet. So, you know, I don't know how it's going to go, but just reading the incredible that, you know, now it's across a whole country, to establish an evaluation program. So what I'd like to do is run through, I think I've got about 7 steps. It could have been broken into more steps or fewer steps, so that's not so important. But I wanted to go through some steps in designing an evaluation program, sort of taking a step back and saying today, what do you do if you're asked to do this? One, the first thing, of course, is to identify the purposes to be served by evaluation. And for U.S. programs, it's pretty much, to guide management, program management strategy, and for accountability and public policy. So those are the main categories. And then under that, there are some details. And then sometimes you get special requests, which you may not know in advance. The second step is to develop an understanding and a model of the program to be evaluated. Very important. You don't just jump in. I mean, you could, and you could probably get it largely right, but unless you really understand the program, it's very hard to develop a model for evaluation. And I think Robert might have mentioned, or Richard, I forget which said it now, pointed out that the program had a scientific dimension and it had an economic dimension, and I would also say it had a business dimension. So when I arrived at ATP in 1990, there wasn't a model, and there were some, it was like the elephant trying to describe it. There were scientists who were describing it largely as a scientific program. There were business people who had been invited in because we were to interface with business who saw it as a business program. And then there were the economists who saw it for social benefits, as a program that had those dimensions. But the modeling was a very important early step. To do that, one can look at program documents, of course, the source documents, interview stakeholders, conduct studies of underlying program structure, and construct descriptive program models. When I was asked to work on the Austrian genomic program, I spent a couple of weeks in Vienna going around to ministries and to scientists and interviewing people at a policy level, people who were applying to the program, the university folks, and got a real broad view of what people who were interfacing with the program thought about it, and then, of course, did a lot of desk analysis using document review and so on to try to figure out what was the program. And then the next thing we did to do this was to construct a program logic model, which is you hear a lot about in the evaluation circles now. It's become more formalized than it used to be. 18 years ago, we were doing this, but we didn't use the lingo quite as it's used today. But what we ended up doing after the several weeks of interviews was we brought the program people together in a single room all day. They were, they couldn't get away from us. And we had a large board, and we had lots of cards. And we constructed the program with them, where we had already, we being the evaluators, had already done a dry run of what we thought it was. But we didn't want to impose that. We worked with the program people to see how they would structure it. And then, of course, by questions here and there, we could kind of work it out. And by the end of the day, the program director said, I never knew that I could see my program on a single page before. So it was, sort of an aha moment for the program people. And, of course, for evaluators, it's sort of like, but you go along with the excitement of the aha self-discovery moment. But if you go through the mission of what a program is to do, and then again, as Robert and Richard mentioned, you've got phases, you've got a time dimension over which things happen, and you need to figure out roughly, you may not know exactly, I think we were always a little overly optimistic in ATP about when things would happen, when innovation results would come to fruition. It takes a long time, and it sometimes takes a lot longer than, we think up front, and the companies also thought. So you work out the phases of your performance program cycle, and then out of that you can begin to see what kind of expectations you have, what kind of questions do you have at each phase. And I like, increasingly as I've gone through years of evaluation, I like to think of these in terms of questions to be answered. What are we trying to do with evaluation? So you can begin to map your evaluation program directly to the program that is to be evaluated. And this is just an illustrative model with some shorthand questions given underneath each phase. So we're starting with the upfront design of the program and going all the way out to benefits, long-term benefits, and everything that comes in between. So, again, the next step, as I see it, would be to formulate in detail the questions that need to be answered. For example, you have different evaluation purposes. You have efficiency questions like, are we efficiently delivering some particular activity? And you have your ultimate success questions. And, again, you have a lot of questions in between. You also have questions that are aimed more for your internal management purposes, and you have questions for accountability. So in ATP, for example, internally we might have been wanting to know were certain types of project characteristics mapping to what we expected, how we expected those things to turn out. And for accountability, we would have had trendable indicators as most other agencies have. And we have diverse audiences to satisfy, and they speak different languages. And, of course, the evaluation program needs to map to these different audiences. And we have the different time periods that's been mentioned before. And we also have different levels of scrutiny, which became very important for ATP. But some kinds of evaluation results are non-controversial. They're fact-based, and everybody sort of can accept them and probably not have much deliberation about them. And others, of course, results are subject to much more controversy. When I hit this first in my career at NIST before joining ATP, I was asked to assess a tobacco-related kind of program. And I was told that it would come under great scrutiny by the tobacco industry, by the healthcare workers, by the government policymakers, by everybody that you could imagine. We had a whole board full of constituents, all of which would hate the study and would attack it. So I learned the meaning of scrutiny on that particular activity. Now, the fifth step, as I see it, is to develop a plan for answering the questions. So you've got a set of questions. You could say you've got a set of information to be found. I like to say questions. And then about the questions, you have some questions. And that is, what kinds of questions are you trying to answer? And it's helpful to identify the type of questions. For example, descriptive questions are among the easiest to answer. They're not always that easy, but they're pretty easy. For example, you can conduct a survey and say and describe how many people are doing a particular thing. The normative questions are really comparing the outcomes against targets and saying, are you doing what you thought you were doing? Are you doing what you plan to do? And impact questions are the terrifically hard questions, which are questions that relate back to, did your program cause the effect, the impact to occur? Very, very tough here. Not just did something happen, but did your program cause it to happen, and to what extent that it caused it to happen? Now we're talking about some real exciting questions for economists and other evaluators. Okay, we want to know what evaluation methods are needed and what information is needed in support of those. we want to know who is best to implement the solution to these questions. And I think before it was mentioned that there's an internal component and an external component. And I'll come back to that a little bit later. But I think there's a role for both. I was at a workshop last week with the Agricultural Research Service, and they were planning to do more evaluation. And the question came up of did they need someone internally to champion evaluation. And it's more than champion, but you really need an internal component. I've tried that before where you approach a program that has no one inside and to that is concerned with evaluation or knows what it is or has done anything in preparation, and those are tough to get your hands around. So I think there's an internal role, and some things can best be collected by an internal staff, but there's a really essential external component for credibility and to enlarge your capacity to bring in experts and so on. Having been in both positions, I appreciate both equally, I think. And then there's the question of when. When will each question need to be addressed, and when will planning need to start? Well, of course, planning needs to start immediately, but the specific details of planning can unfold as you go along, as we'll see in ATP's case. The next step is to develop a data collection plan. And you want to know, given that you've got these questions, given that you've thought about when and how and who and all of these kinds of things, you're at the point of sort of getting a handle on what data will be collected, who will collect it, how will it be collected, how will it be made available to evaluators. This is assuming that some data will be collected internally, and then there's the interface with external folks. How will issues of confidentiality be handled? And that was an issue in ATP. Every day we had a lot of proprietary and confidential information, and we had to straddle between the need for evaluators to know and to have an open kind of shop and versus the need to protect proprietary and confidential information. The last step, I believe, maybe it's not my last step. Anyway, one of the later steps is to identify methods of evaluation. And again, whether it comes before or after data, you know, the data thing, but it really kind of comes at the same time, I think. You have a number of types of evaluation strategies, and you have a number of practitioners that come from different disciplines that could be involved in evaluation. And you also have the sort of interesting thing that a lot of the people who are doing evaluation don't really call themselves evaluators. Increasingly they do, but I know when I first started this, I was an economist who did benefit cost studies and other types of microeconomic analysis of programs, and I was doing evaluation, but I wouldn't have called myself an evaluator. Increasingly, there's an association for evaluators, there are organizations for evaluators, and people have distilled a number of approaches into sort of methods where they have names, more recognizable names, and it's not just each person kind of doing their own thing. You can begin to see categories of approaches that fall into, for example, these kind of bins: peer review, monitoring, data collection, bibliometrics, including citation analysis and data mining, and some of the more advanced citation approaches, network analysis, historical tracing, case study, survey, benchmarking, benefit cost, econometrics, and others. Okay, I've got to move along. Anyway, I'd like to talk more about the methods, which is what I talked about last week, but for the interest of time, I'm going to move along. Okay, why multiple methods? Well, you've got different kinds of questions. You've got alternative perspectives. You need multiple lines of evidence, and you need to meet multiple purposes that your evaluation is serving. And you have the implementation stage, which comes next. Now, in Austria, we kind of presented our plan and waltzed away, and I am told now that they are implementing, but we didn't stick around for the hard stuff, I guess. And now what I want to do in the last few minutes I have is to talk about the development of ATP's evaluation. It conforms very nicely, I'm happy to say, and somewhat relieved to say, to the steps that I just presented. But there's a big but. It was more evolutionary. We were finding our way through the maze as budget and staff and insight allowed. So when I was brought in 1990, and I was one of the early people hired in ATP, my boss said, you know, we need to do something, an assessment. You go do that. And by the way, you have $25,000 to the first year to do it. So you can imagine it was evolutionary. And why? Well, first of all, it was 18 years ago. It predated, as you've heard, the GPRA, which was passed in 93, and really didn't come into real effect until 94. So it was 4 years in front of GPRA. It was, 11 years in front of PART. There were no good comprehensive models at the time, and I apologize to those of you who were perhaps doing comprehensive analysis at the time. As you all know, the U.S. evaluation system is extremely distributed, extremely heterogeneous, and it's hard to get your hand around who's doing what. Now there are a few organizations that help with that, but at the time, you know, it was sort of word of mouth of, I hear someone over at so-and-so is doing something. And so we were in search of good models, but what we were finding was large piecemeal efforts. As I said, I was involved in piecemeal efforts myself at NIST in evaluation. Now, why did ATP's evaluation program emerge as a leader in absence of the GPRA in part? And I make this assertion with some confidence. We've been called that by others. We're looked to by programs abroad and in the U.S., and so I think there's some evidence of this. First of all, I would say there was strong support by ATP's management early on for internal use, and the director at the time told me, you know, have at it, no holds barred, not protective, experimental, the program's experimental, so will be the evaluation program. So I had an open book to work with. A second thing was the existing NIST experience with evaluation didn't hurt, and I don't want to make that sound easier than it was, but it was, by comparison, a rather friendly institution for evaluation and for measurement, of course. And another not to be forgotten important thing here was that there was a legislative requirement in ATP when it was set up that 4 years out there would be an evaluation, there would be a report to Congress, okay, about the program. So we had an external requirement that predated GPRA. And ATP had an administrative budget that allowed for evaluation. Although, as I said, it was quite small to begin with, ATP was allowed up to 10% of its total budget that could be used for administration. That means everything. And one of the things in the pot was evaluation. Well, I've worked a lot with SBIR in recent years in assessing that, including NSF's SBIR program. And that's a program that was really squeezed in terms of having available funding for any type of evaluation. So that's not to be ignored either. Having resources is important. And those resources were growing over time, even though they started with one study at under 25,000. It grew each year. The experimental nature of ATP meant that there was no status quo that we were coming up against. There was no protection, although I won't say there was no protection as we went on. We, like everybody else, had to get through public affairs with our reports, and, you know, there was a lot of sensitivity to critical results. But because the director was supporting this open climate to evaluation, it was much better than it sometimes is at other places. There was the perceived need over time that ever more robust evaluation was needed in the face of growing political opposition to ATP. We had this really funny world. From 1990 to 1994, we perceived our problem was how in the world were we going to scale up as fast as we had to go. And then, of course, we were mentioned in President Clinton's economic plan as the flagship of economic growth. Bullseye went on us. Okay, 94, the Congress makeup changed, and our internal problems became quite different. Rather than how to scale up, it was, you know, kind of how to exist, I guess, how to continue. And so every evaluation study was met with more and more opposition, which meant that we rose to the challenge. You know, so that's one reason our evaluation program developed as it was. It was tested by fire. If we did a study and we thought we had strong evidence, and then we saw where the weak points were, the next time around we tried to get stronger. So that actually ended up with a more robust program. And then lastly, for a number of reasons, we had the ability to attract leading evaluators outside to advise the program and to participate in ATP's evaluation program. And I think part of that came because there was an interest in this new sort of new on the kid on the block, the public-private partnership programs, and we were able to attract some of the just big names in evaluation, Zvi Grilekes, Edwin Mansfield, Brownlin Hall, Adam Jaffe, all kinds of people that most people in evaluation would know. In fact, at that time in the early years, I'd say this would be about 92, the DOC Inspector General, for whatever reason, was sent down to be my shadow. And if I turned around, I ran into him. He was right there. And those of you who are over on that side of the wall will know I had the feeling of being a criminal. I was like, what have I done? You know, I'm trying to develop this evaluation, but it was like somehow it was real heavy. So I said to him, let's talk about what we're trying to do. I said, you know, we're trying to build this evaluation program, and I said, we're creating this group of advisors, and why don't you come to our meeting? Why don't you, you know, have a first-hand look at what we're doing? Well, it just blew him away. When he came in the room and he saw who was there, he was like, you know, how wonderful it was. And we got the phrase exemplary used in the Inspector General's report on the ATP's evaluation, which gave us a lot of, you know, a real boost at the time. And I'll wind up with a few lessons learned. First of all, we're the poster child for the first one. Evaluation is necessary but not sufficient for program survival. I think one reason that the program was able to stay along under such intense opposition for so long was that it was showing strong results. And so, you know, it was really the attack sort of shifted from impact to more relevancy in terms of what was this particular approach needed. Another lesson learned was the legitimate roles for internal and external components. And we were kind of working our way through that as we went in terms of what did we need to do ourselves and what did we need to farm out to others. And we always knew there was a balance there. And I think ATP has continued in that mode. And the another one is that evaluation is a field that has emerged considerably over the past 18 years, but there's still much to be learned. It's still an emerging field. it's not all tied up with a bow, neat, and, you know, all things known. It's an area that there's still pioneers in. There's still methods that are being developed. There's still much to be learned because we're talking about how to get a handle on innovation and technology and science impacts, and those are very, very tough areas. And some challenges to conclude. One thing is to gain better understanding of evaluation by stakeholders. That is, the stakeholders often become a difficulty. They're the customer. But the difficulty is in conveying complex, kind of difficult stuff to clients who come from other disciplines. And I think this was recognized in the last several years by GAO, who was actually holding some training courses for OMB and other analysts who came from different disciplines who would be dropped in on you, you know, to assess your evaluation, who might not really know that much about it. So that was sort of a continuous thing, that it was difficult to talk about some of these more complex studies with people who maybe were quite impatient with the whole subject. Another thing that was touched on earlier was this extending evaluation methods to provide useful and reliable measures, for example, for program portfolios. Increasingly, you hear the lingo, but what about the portfolio? I'm working on a project now in renewable energy, which, by the way, is kind of as an aside, to show how things come full circle, just like hymns go up and hymns go down. In the 1970s, I was doing benefit cost analysis of solar energy, you know, when everybody was talking renewable energy. And then it went away for years. And now I have a project in benefit cost analysis and citation analysis in renewable energy, but a different type. Okay, so things come around, and my prediction is ATP or a similar kind of program will come around again. It's too good not to, I think. And I'll conclude with this thought. I believe we had in the room a person who was co-directing this Science of Science policy effort, and I've been a little bit involved in that, and so I think we need better bridging between the needs and uses of evaluation for program management, for accountability, and including stretching out to informing public science policy. I think those of us who are evaluation know that evaluation has something to say to policy. And yet, when you push on it and you try to explain to policymakers what it has to say, it can get a little bit more difficult than one might think. And so that whole area is one that is just full of challenges. And I'm sure those of you who are in the business know many other challenges, but I'll conclude with that. Thank you.
Well, we have time for a few questions, so Should we start with your question, I guess?
Okay. Questions? Your
one I asked before.
Your
was
question
it,
was
you satisfied with no. Okay.
And right. And
I'll tell you what's in the back of my mind.
Okay.
Can you use the microphone, please?
I could. I have a suspicious mind, so forgive me. But I was wondering if the current administration's view of science contributed to the demise of the ATP program.
The question is, does the current administration's view of science contribute to the demise of ATP? And that's one that I'm not really sure about. I think that that the sort of feeding frenzy started a long time ago, back in the mid-90s. And I know I've been in the room before with some policy people a couple of years ago who were having this discussion, and they were saying, well, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. There's so much talk about ATP, and they keep trying to kill it. There must be something wrong with it. And I was like, au contraire, it's not that there's something wrong with it. As long as you accept the model of public-private partnerships, Now, you've got to, you know, go there. Is there a role for public-private partnerships? If you hate that idea, you're going to hate the ATP. If you believe that there are some type of market failures, as Richard mentioned, where you've got your generic technology, high risk, infrastructure kinds of questions. One that was not mentioned, collaboration. A lot of these projects were to overcome barriers of collaboration that needed to bring different parties that typically were not coming to the same table to solve these, you know, larger kinds of problems. If you accept that premise, you'll love ATP. If you don't accept that premise, you know, where do you go? You end up where we are. But it wasn't about a failure of the program to deliver. It was a failure of the program to bring enough people in the policy area to a position that they accepted that there was a role for this kind of program. I think it was like that. And then political issues on the side.
I just wanted to add to Rosalie's explanation. I don't think it was certainly not in this current administration that it had something to do with science. I think that when budgets are tight, I know that, you know, in the late 90s, there were several arguments where universities and federal labs felt threatened by programs like the Advanced Technology Program, where they felt millions of dollars were being taken away from, you know, their budget. It's not a zero-sum game. No matter how you say it, it doesn't work that way, and there's only so much fight. And I think this latest American Competes Act, there was a lot of attention paid to infrastructure, to selecting big areas of science or, you know, technology that would be supported. And in the end, none of these programs really got a lot of money, but there was a lot of discussion about it. I think that when a program is labeled, certain bad labels like corporate welfare, it's very difficult to explain that away. And ATP was very unique in that it wasn't just serving small companies. It was agnostic in terms of size because it wanted to leave that decision on who you wanted to partner with the people who were applying. We didn't want to arbitrarily decide on that. But I think that politically that's very difficult. So even though the mission was provided to us, a lot of people saw some deficiencies, and those arguments are just very difficult to overcome. And even with a very good evaluation program, it's insufficient when you don't have political support.
Obviously, you raised a very provocative question.
Can we have a question?
Yes. I remember back in the mid-90s when the Republicans took over Congress, there was talk of abolishing the entire Department of Commerce, as I recall. So it's not just it wasn't
just us. No, it wasn't. But I think, again, when you have a complex program, and, you know, it does have these different dimensions. It's got the science, contribute to science knowledge dimension. It's got the engage U.S. businesses dimension, and it's got the social benefits, you know, dimension. That's your ultimate goal, is not for corporate welfare, but for larger social benefits. And ATP was always able to prove that the social benefits from its areas funded far exceeded the private return. So, you know, we were clean on that, but that's not a bumper sticker. And so it's hard when you've got a complex program and you're living in a world of bumper stickers like this, to say that and get it and have it received that quickly. Thanks again.
Thank you. All right, well, I guess we have one more question, and we'll take a break at 10:15. You will take one more, if you don't mind.
Yeah. Thank you. On the question of evaluation design, you mentioned that the ATP was a large program, from my perspective, and diverse in scope or in the dimensions that you mentioned. If the evaluation resources are constrained, would you say there's value in doing a more focused evaluation of a component of a program like that, or do you really need that comprehensive perspective to do it effectively?
Well, that's a tough one. The question is, if you've got very limited resources, do you go small? Do you focus in on some particular thing, or do you go larger? And I think I'm somewhat shifting over time. I think earlier I would have said go small and do it well, you know, because I come out of a microeconomic approach, and I always wanted to know as much as I could about something. Right now, I'm focused more in one of the projects I'm doing, the citation analysis and the benefit cost analysis. They wanted me to go larger with the whole technology innovation subject area and not pick it apart, which, you know, was my tendency. Okay, so I'm rolling up into more of a portfolio approach, and I believe I can do that, but I'll do it probably by agri building up rather than, you know, last week at the ag workshop, they kept talking about disaggregation. I, you know, my thought is more aggregation up. That's a hard one. I think in ATP we started with the survey. That was our first study. And our first study was open-ended survey. We didn't want to presume what kinds of impacts we were having. We wanted to discover what kinds of impacts. You know, we could sit in a room and draw and write what kind of impacts we expect, but we wanted to solicit that information. So our first small study that we did was to go out and say, what do people who are interfacing with us believe the impacts are? Very open-ended, and of course we could distill that. So, you know, that's not a terribly sharp answer, but that's a very complex question, a very difficult question that you've asked. It's a matter of judgment, I would say. What are you trying to do, and who's your audience? If you've got one key audience, and you know what they need, and that's life or death, go with that.
Rosalie, that was a fantastic speech. Thank you very much. A few comments that I'd like to just pass along. I just can't emphasize enough the fact that ATP made an early, early commitment to evaluation, as Rosalie has emphasized. And again, the parts that both Rob and I emphasize, the fact that it's a multifaceted approach.